Chapter 17. At the appointed time, Purslane and I were ready on the 18th level landing stage. We had brought Hesperus with us, in the open rear compartment of a personal flyer belonging to Gentian Line. A wind was whipping in from the west, flags rippling and dancing on the bridges and walkways between the towers. Dust stung my cheeks and clawed at my wind-slitted eyes. Not many Emirians were in the air this afternoon, unless they were inside the shelter of machines. I was glad to be away from Mazerian's interrogation room, but misgivings were tying knots in my stomach. "Here he comes," Purslane said, pointing to an insect-bodied craft fluttering towards us, its wings a blur of pastel colours. The flying thing hovered against the sun, forcing me to raise my hands against the glare. For a moment it looked as if it was about to turn around and fly away. "Who's in it?" "Someone from the Study Council," is all Jindabyne would say. As if the occupant had made up their mind, the craft lowered its nose and approached the landing stage. It touched down and a figure emerged from the pearl-shaped cabin at the front, grasping handrails and stepping down with his back to us before turning around. It was a male, dressed in a padded black outfit with fur-lined collar and cuffs. There were many pockets, straps, and nozzles on the outfit, which was festooned with thick, ribbed airlines, leading to a heavy snout-like breathing mask, suspended below the creature's goggled face. He walked to us with an impatient, slightly waddling gait. "I'm Purslane," my co-shatterling said. "This is Campion, a fellow shatterling. It's good of you to help us."
"I was ordered to help you. I had no say in the matter."
He had the same honey-coloured fur as Magistrate Jindabyne, but his fur was flecked with little dabs of white, perhaps the sign of age, stress, or some genetic irregularity in his pigmentation.
"Do you approve?" I asked.
"Absolutely not. If I had my way, you'd never have been allowed into our atmosphere in the first place."
"That's a bit extreme," I said.
"I've been studying the spirit my entire adult life, Shatterling. I have never known it be as agitated, as unpredictable, as when your ship started appearing around our planet. It doesn't care for you. It would rather you left. So, frankly, would I."
"Nice to know we're welcome," I said.
"It's nothing personal."
"Of course it isn't. And you'd be..."
"You may call me Mr. Jinx."
"We're sorry to cause so much trouble," Purslane said. "We're only doing this for our friend. He's sick and we think he wanted to meet the spirit. In fact, it was the last thing he told us before he stopped communicating at all. You can understand why we want to do what's right by him, can't you?"
If Mr. Jinx was prepared to grant us even the tiniest concession, the only outward indication of it was a throat-clearing sound. On reflection, it could just as easily have indicated an even more profound degree of irritation. "We are already late," he said, ignoring the fact that we were exactly on time according to the agreed arrangements. "I'd have chosen to be safely away from the observation tower by now. Never mind. Your tardiness cannot be helped. Are you ready to follow me?"
I nodded towards the rear of the hovering flyer.
"We have our friend with us. Do you want to see him for yourself?"
"It won't make any difference what I think of him."
"I just thought..."
"Your chances of achieving success are negligible, much poorer than your chances of injury or death, which are excellent."
Mr. Jinx turned and began to strut back towards his machine. "Follow me, remain a safe distance behind me, and do not deviate from my flight path," he called over his shoulder. We returned to the flyer.
"He's a cheerful soul. It's so good to know he's fully on our side, backing us all the way."
"In his shoes I'd probably feel just as put out," Purslane said, climbing into one of the two forward-facing seats. "He's been given a diktat from on high to do what we say. It's no wonder he's a little aggrieved."
"A little."
Mr. Jinx was airborne in a few seconds. He spun the nose of his flying machine around and dashed away, swerving hard to slip between the densely packed towers of Ymir. Purslane willed the flyer to follow him, the acceleration pressing me into my seat before the nullifier smoothed out the ride. The pink-hulled craft had no cockpit canopy, save for two half-hemisphere cowls, positioned ahead of the two leading seats. For a few instants we were blasted by the wind, until the flyer snapped an aerodynamic field around itself.
All of a sudden it was as still and silent as if we were in a hot air balloon.
"Maybe it's madness after all," Perslane said, "like throwing a broken clock into a whirlwind and hoping it'll end up miraculously repaired."
"Except a whirlwind was never alive. We know the spirit of the air started out as a living intelligence. What we don't know is how much of that intelligence is left in there."
I twisted around to check that Hesperus was still secure in the rear compartment. He was more to us than a broken clock, anyway. "We're not doing this because we've damaged something and we want it repaired. We're doing this because he was our friend, and he sacrificed himself for us."
"So that gives us license to attempt the impossible?"
"It's not impossible, just a very long shot. It's not as if the spirit hasn't intervened in similar ways before."
"But not with machine people?"
"Only because they don't come here."
"There might be a reason for that. Maybe they're too sensible, or the Emyrians don't let them."
"Or maybe there's something here that scares them," I said. "A mechanized intelligence older than they are. They think we're about as complex and subtle as a game of noughts and crosses. Maybe they see through us that easily. But how would they react to something genuinely complex, genuinely unfathomable? I think they'd feel about it the way we'd feel about spending a night in a haunted castle." I smiled. "All of a sudden I appear to be the one doing the persuading, incidentally. I seem to remember this was your idea, not mine."
"I get second thoughts occasionally."
"Well, don't. This is the right thing, no matter what Jindabyne or Jinx has to say. A Gentian flyer would always be faster than an ornithopter, even with a heavy payload. And before very long we had caught up with Mr. Jinx's flying machine. Perslane could have drawn alongside, but she held us just behind the other vehicle, as we had been instructed. Within 10 minutes, the black fingers supporting Ymir had begun to drop away below the eastern horizon, and after 20, only the very tops of the highest structures were visible. Below us was a labyrinth of shadowed white dunes, as coiled and tangled as the human cerebellum. We had seen the observation tower from the magistrate's office, but I had not guessed its true significance until now. It was a bone-white stalk rising from the dunes, surmounted by a flat observation platform braced to the stalk by filigreed struts. Mr. Jinx flew higher and we followed him, until both craft were level with the platform. It was a round dish about 200 meters across, with a slope-sided, windowless building placed in the middle. Mr. Jinx landed first, next to the building. Perslane brought the flyer down and we both got out. Mr. Jinx was emerging from the Emyrian flying machine. "Get him out now. Do you see that smudge on the horizon to the left of the reflection of the sun?"
"The one that looks like a storm cloud or a flock of starlings?" Perslane asked.
"That's the spirit of the air. It's nearer than I expected. It must have traveled quickly since the last monitoring update. We'd better get on with this. It will already be aware of our presence on the platform."
"It looked very far away, like a weather system we would not have to worry about until tomorrow."
"Is it coming nearer?" Perslane asked.
"It may come, it may not, but the fact that it is visible at all is an indication that it will probably choose to approach."
We had fixed carryalls to Hesperus. I took hold of the U-shaped handle of the nearest one and lifted his body out of the flyer, feeling the full brunt of his inertia, but no sense of his weight. I pushed the huge golden mass sideways until it had cleared the flyer. Where would be the best place to put him?
"As far away from the shelter as possible," Mr. Jinx said. "There is a small plinth near the western edge. We've sometimes left samples there."
I had not seen the plinth during our approach because it had been hidden by the shelter. Walking slowly but surely, I propelled Hesperus ahead of me single-handedly. The plinth the Emyrian had mentioned was nothing more than a raised portion of the floor, with a flattened surface. I brought Hesperus to a halt above it, and then lowered the levator I was holding until I felt him crunch to a halt.
"Remove the levators now," Mr. Jinx said. "If you wish to make an offering to the spirit, you should avoid any external complications."
"It's not exactly an offering," Perslane said.
"That's for the spirit to decide, not you."
I nodded and detached the four carryalls, then coupled them together so that they could be pushed as a single unit.
"Will that do?" I asked, stepping back to study the thing I had left on the plinth. The fused part of Hesperus was turned away from me. I could still see his humanoid form, with that handsome and serene face staring out at me, his torso, right arm and leg free of the encasing mass. The lights were still gyring in his skull window, but I had never seen them move so dimly, or so sluggishly.
"I think it's closer," Perslane said, looking out at the strange dark cloud.
"It is," Mr. Jink said. "If it chooses to visit, it could be on us within 30 minutes."
He started walking at a brisk pace back to his flying machine.
"You should leave now. You have done all you need to do."
"We'd like to stay here," Perslane said. She glanced quickly at me. "I'm going to stay anyway."
"I cannot recommend this course of action.
If we leave, the spirit will assume Hesperus is an offering, like you said, but he isn't some fatted calf we're giving away to make the rains come. We want him to be healed. The spirit has to understand that he means something to us."
"Staying will not accomplish that."
"But nothing else will send the same signal," Perslane said. "I've thought this through, Mr. Jinx. If I put myself at risk, the spirit will see that Hesperus isn't just some piece of metal we don't care about. He's a person, a friend."
"You overestimate the degree to which the spirit can be assumed to indulge in rational deduction."
"I'm willing to take that chance."
"Me too," I said.
"You don't have to stay, Campion."
"Nor do you." The truth was, I did not share Perslane's determination. I was apprehensive, and that alien thing on the horizon was unnerving me. But I could not let her go through this alone.
"We can find our own way back to Ymir," Perslane said. "Not without a flyer."
"We have one," she pointed out.
"It can't stay here. If the spirit arrives, it will be destroyed. It doesn't like other machines, even very simple ones. If you are still here when the spirit has passed, you can summon back the flyer."
"And the levators?" I asked.
"Send them away as well. It would be best to dispose of any machinery you are carrying now."
"There are things in my head," Perslane said. "My ship speaks to me through them."
"It would have been wise to mention them sooner."
"I didn't think about them."
"It can't be helped now. You had better hope that the spirit ignores them."
Mr. Jinx cast a wary eye at the restless, flexing shape on the horizon. "Provided the machines in your head remain quiet, you should be all right."
Perslane closed her eyes for an instant. "I've just told Silverwings to go off air."
I moved to the flyer, placed the carry-alls in the rear compartment, then leaned into the pilot's position and told it to fly away until morning. It would mean us spending a night in the shelter, but that was the least of my worries now.
Mr. Jinx paused at the side of his flying machine, his hands on the rails either side of its door.
"You are set on this course of action. It is not too late to back out now. But once I am gone, you are on your own. There is no way off this tower unless you count falling. Unfortunately, I do not think any of your machines would be able to reach you in time."
"We're ready," Perslane said.
"I must admit I am curious as to the outcome. A tiny part of me wishes to remain here, to witness the spectacle at close quarters."
"Will you be watching us?"
"From a distance. No recording devices have ever survived an encounter with the spirit. There are telescopes trained on the platform, but they don't see very much when the spirit is present."
"You could stay," I said.
"A larger, saner part of me has no intention of doing so."
The wind slapped across my face without warning. Mr. Jinx smiled at my astonished reaction.
"You felt that, didn't you, Shatterling? The microclimate is moving in. The spirit brings its own weather with it. I must be away now."
"Go," I said. "We'll be fine. We'll tell you all about it in the morning."
Something in Mr. Jinx's mood had eased. Perhaps he had accepted our explanation, that we had no alternative except to help our friend.
"I wish you luck. I consider you to be misguided, but I cannot say that you are lacking in courage."
With that, Jinx climbed into his craft and sped away in a flicker of mechanical wings. The flyer lifted from the platform and headed in the same general direction, back to the city, where it would wait until the break of day. Perslane and I stood together and watched the two dots diminish, until they were no longer distinguishable from the sky. The wind hardened, cutting into my eyes as if with a razor. I raised a hand to screen it, peering through the gaps in my fingers. The sun, lowering towards the western horizon, was hazed behind a smoky, undulating mass.
The colour was somewhere between purple and black, and the twisting, billowing shape appeared to be made up of myriad tiny constituents. I struggled to judge the scale. There was nothing to provide a reference point. But the central mass of the spirit, the dark, beating clot at its heart, where the density of aerial machines was the highest, must have been at least as wide as the observation platform. I had felt trepidation before, but it had been the optimistic trepidation of someone contemplating a hazardous but grand enterprise, like scaling a summit or creating a magnificent art form. Now that trepidation sharpened into magnificent animal fear. It was telling me to run or hide from this approaching thing, and it took every ounce of my resolve to stand my ground. I thought of what the Trove had told me, and what I had also learned from the Emirians. The spirit of the air had once been a human man, back in the twilight centuries of the Golden Hour. His name had been Abraham Valmik, or something similar, a man of immeasurable wealth and considerable longevity, who nonetheless wanted more out of the universe than it had so far given him. By then, Abigail and the other line founders had already shattered themselves into the likes of us, choosing one pathway to immortality, and had begun their knowledge-thirsty spread into an empty galaxy. Perhaps others had already embarked on the long process of change that would turn them into the curators of vigilance, choosing a different pathway. For Valmik, neither shattering, time dilation nor biological transformation offered sufficient guarantees. He wished instead to make himself into a machine, so that his consciousness might be embodied in something as close to indestructible as physics allowed. Neuron by neuron, he allowed his brain to be supplanted by mechanical parts. Since the process was gradual, akin to the continuous redevelopment of a city, rather than sudden demolition and replacement, the man felt no change in his consciousness between the replacement of one neuron and the next. But that was not to say that he did not become strange to those who had known him, as his mind was slowly transformed into a humming web of artificial neurons. When the process was done, the man discarded his old body as it was no longer useful to his needs. He could still puppet an organic nervous system when circumstances required it, but they were few and far between. He preferred to interact with the abstract realm of simulated experience, only rarely bothering to communicate with the people he had left behind in the outside world. They bored him now. Their habits of thought seemed painfully predictable, as if their minds were running on tramlines. He felt different, like a fish that had flopped onto dry land and found that it could still breathe, while everyone else was still stuck in the ocean. He had nothing in common with them now. For centuries, Valmik's artificial mind existed in a fixed architecture, in a fixed location. There were copies of him scattered through the Golden Hour and beyond its civilized fringes, but they were only to be activated in the event of damage to or the demise of the primary mind. Over time, he had added to his complexity, integrating more and more artificial neurons into his mind, until they exceeded the number of functional cells in his original brain by a factor of many hundreds. By then he was so far from human that his only useful companions were other ascended minds. For a while, they kept pace with him, until he began to ease ahead. They were too cautious, too unwilling to cast aside the last residual traces of human brain architecture. They clung to ancient wiring, archaic, hallowed arrangements of sensory and cognitive modules. The structure of the human mind was a thing that had evolved through accident and happenstance, layering each new addition over the old. It was like a ramshackle mansion that had been added to over many generations, with corridors and staircases that led nowhere, neglected rooms and hallways that could not be enlarged because they were hemmed in by others, plumbing that was fiendishly, unnecessarily complex, because each new installation had had to be rooted around a pre-existing tangle of rusty pipes and drains. The others did not have the courage to sweep this jumbled, top-heavy heritage aside. He did. He was braver, bolder, less afraid of losing himself. He vowed to remake himself from the bottom up, reorganizing his basic architecture from the very foundations of his mind. No part of his brain would be left unexamined. Knots would be straightened out. Modules moved around or deleted entirely. Throughout this process, consciousness would endure. It would grow faint as the changes reached their most radical phases, but it would never be entirely extinguished. The planning would need to be meticulous, Like a surgeon, groggy with his own anaesthetic, he would not be sufficiently clear-minded to intervene halfway through if something went amiss. All contingencies must be allowed for. As it was, nothing went wrong. He just became something weirder, larger, faster than he had been before. The old mansion was now a shining, rationally organized edifice. He was pristine and efficient. Thoughts raced through him with blinding clarity. He looked back on what he had done to himself and saw that it was good. He saw also that he had left behind his old companions forever. The process of improvement, of adjusting his architecture, continued unabated. Even if one of the others had a change of heart and decided to emulate what he had done, they would never catch up. He had become something unique, something that might not have existed since the Priors. But Valmik was not finished. Although he was better than he had been, incalculably so, he was still bound to one location, locked in the processing core of a single machine. That machine, once its power source, outer layers and armor were taken into account, was as large as a small asteroid. In this era, long before the trivial secrets of space-time, momentum and inertia were unlocked, it was about as easy to move around. He had to keep himself cool by boiling comets away to steam. He had become godlike in the private realm of his own mental processes, but he was still vastly, humblingly dependent on other machines and other human beings. If that flow of comets was interrupted, he would boil in his own brilliance. It would only take a single, well-aimed weapon to destroy the machine in which he lived. That was not good enough. The change that he forced upon himself took him even further from humanity, but by now being human was a landmass on a very distant horizon, one that he would not mourn when it eventually slipped out of sight. Every one of the tens of thousands of billions of neurons that constituted his mind was allowed to become an independent machine, capable of taking care of its own survival. In those early days, he still needed fuel and raw materials. He had not yet learned the simple trick of tapping vacuum for those basic nourishments, but the machines were clever and agile enough to find their own resources. Remaining in contact with each other via light, he became a cloud consciousness, occupying a much larger volume than ever before. In fact, the cloud could swell as wide as he wished. If he wanted to englobe a planet, to wrap himself around it, that was no problem. The only price he paid was a slowing in his mental processes, as the light-speed lag between his components grew from microseconds to entire fractions of a second. Since there was nothing else in the universe he was interested in talking to except himself, this was not a pressing concern. He could even smear himself across an entire solar system, and beyond. Long after the Golden Hour was a historical memory, long after the Shatterlings had made their third reunion, those first three circuits encompassed a mere 7,000 years, since Abigail saw no sense in exploring more of the galaxy than had yet been colonized, the man had swelled to inhabit the Oort cloud, that halo of dormant comets orbiting between 1,000 and 100,000 times as far from the sun as the old place. Now the simplest thoughts consumed months of planetary time. The solar system whirred inside him like an overwound clock. Vast in size and number, though he had become, Valmik was easy to miss. Because he played no part in human affairs, humans eventually forgot about him. There were stories about a thread of ghostly transmissions webbing the Oort, but no one took them any more seriously than a million other myths. When explorers stumbled on one of his elements, they normally assumed it was a piece of space junk from the dawn of the expansion. He sacrificed it anyway. He was incapable of being hurt or even inconvenienced by any imaginable human agency. Even the growing power of the lines caused him no qualms. But the sun might be a problem. In the decelerated frame of his consciousness, the end of its main sequence lifetime lay only a few thousand subjective years away. This was intolerable. Something might be done about it in the distant future, when the lines or some other human civilization had learned the rudimentaries of stellar life prolongation. But he could not count on that, and he would need to start making provisions now, while he still had enough time to mull the possibilities. The cloud consciousness decided that it was time to become interstellar. Rather than gathering himself into a concentrated formation and launching himself towards another star, like a flotilla of ships, albeit in unthinkable numbers, he began to inflate himself, sending his neuronal elements in all directions. It took tens of thousands of years before any single element came within reach of another sun, for the individual parts of him moved much more slowly than the swift ships of the lines. As he grew even more distended, so his thought processes slowed down by yet more orders of magnitude. Expanded into a cloud encompassing dozens of stars, his quickest thoughts ate decades of planetary time. But at last he was free from dependence on any one solar system. At this point, the information in the troves became sketchy and contradictory. It was not clear what had happened to the man for the next million years or so. One line of argument held that he had expanded himself to encompass a massive swathe of galactic space, swallowing hundreds of thousands of systems across thousands of lights. By now the lines were into their seventh, eighth, or ninth reunions, depending on when they had started. The golden hour was a bright, brief moment in time, compressed like a mote of light seen through the wrong end of a telescope. There had been empires within him that had no idea he existed, but the price for such expansion was consciousness frozen to the point of death. It took millennia for him to formulate the simplest thought. The other line of argument held that the man had never grown larger than a few tens of light years across. After reaching the size of a decent nebula, and spending a few hundred thousand years in that state, he had decided that enough was enough. That he was ready to engage with human civilization again, even if it was engagement on his own, rather distant, terms, even if that engagement meant shrinking himself down to a planetary scale. It was not so much of a hardship, for in the time of his expansion, he had learned much about self-preservation. He no longer needed external energy sources. He had observed the early galactic wars of the proto-humans and seen what their weapons could do. Provided he took precautions, provided he remained agile, nothing need trouble him again. What the Troves did agree on was that, one way or the other, the spirit of the air, the fracto-coagulation, was what remained of the man after another 5.5 million years of existence. He had been on Neume for most of that time, since there was no phase of the planet's recorded history that did not make reference to him in some shape or form. Sometimes he had been an elusive, near-mythical presence, hiding himself in obscure ways for centuries at a time, before appearing fleetingly to confused and wary witnesses who were not always believed. At other times, he was a fixed presence in the atmosphere, like the metastable storm in a gas giant. He shunned some civilizations, destroyed others, and showed tolerance and forbearance to others. When the Scaper's plans failed, he maintained Naomi's atmosphere in a breathable state. It was a kindness that cost him nothing. It would have been more trouble not to step on an ant when Valmik had been human. So the theories went. I did not really know how many of them I believed, but the story struck me as at least plausible in its details. If the spirit did not have a machine origin, and it was axiomatic that no machine intelligence had arisen prior to the machine people, then it could only have started with a human, or group of humans. Abigail Gentian had done a daring, audacious thing to herself, so had the other line founders, even at the time that had been declaimers, critics who said that her plan was monstrous and dehumanizing. She had ignored them, of course. I had my existence to thank for it. It would have been presumptuous to assume that no other individual was capable of such visionary thinking, such unflinching willingness to sail beyond the shores of fixed humanity. The spirits came closer, until it filled half the sky, and I discerned that the individual forms had many shapes and sizes. Most of them were no larger than insects, but the more substantial entities were flapping things like bats or birds, but with a distinct mechanical aspect to them. The blade-sharp wings were jointed to the rounded bodies by complex hinges, the eyeless bodies flickering with pastel colors and pricks of laser-sharp light. It required an effort of will to remind myself that this entity was not the product of robotic evolution, not some weird kin to the machine people, but an intelligence that had begun existence in human form and only attained this awesome, weather-like state of being via the accumulation of incremental change over millions of years. The spirit danced and weaved, forming transient shapes in the manner of a three-dimensional kaleidoscope. The wind came in waves with each pulse of change. The sound of it was a mad droning buzz, with extremes of pitch ranging from a subsonic tone that was felt more than heard, to a shrill keening that might shatter my skull at any moment. Perslane tightened her hold on me, and it occurred to me that I had seldom been this frightened, or been so utterly at the mercy of forces beyond my control. Suddenly the idea that we might help Hesperus by bringing him to this place began to seem ludicrous and childish, much as if we had bargained something precious against the existence of fairies. But we were committed now. There was no way off the platform save by the flyer, which would not return for many hours. The spirit began to center itself over the platform, so that instead of filling one half of the sky, it became a storm of change roiling over us, with a band of clear air beneath it in all directions. In the roaring heart of the phenomenon, I made out only blackness, a core of machines packed so tightly, even though they were all independent from each other, that no daylight was able to penetrate. That darkness was relieved only by the intermittent flicker of colored lights, as the numberless units communicated amongst themselves. I felt the lash of rain against my skin, even though there had not been a drop of moisture in the air until the spirit's arrival. Now it began to descend towards us. My instinct was to crouch, but I knew this would be futile and forced myself to remain standing. I glanced at the sanctuary of the building, but we must both have had the same thought, for Perslane shook her head. We had come here to show our devotion to Hesperus, not to cower behind those walls, which were in any case likely to prove ineffective. Perslane extended a hand towards the plinth. Above the roar she managed to say, "Let's go there! Let's show it why we're here!" I knew she was right. Still holding each other, we walked across the platform until we were only a few paces from where we had left Hesperus. He seemed to watch us. No glimmer of recognition showed in his eyes, but the lights in his head quickened for a few intervals, before dimming and slowing again. Now they appeared darker than they had even when we had placed him on the plinth. The spirit lowered further, until its outer edges blocked the sky in all directions, filtering the sunlight as if twilight had already fallen. The roar had now become almost intolerable, and the black core hung over us like a swallowing mouth. From the purple margin of that blackness, a vortex of machines began to curl down in an inquisitive fashion, whirling like debris caught in a twister. The vortex tapered to a questing extremity. The probe dangled over Hesperus without touching him, approaching and withdrawing on several occasions. It was impossible not to sense some great apprehension from the spirit of the air, for all its undoubted power. I wondered if in all its years of existence it had ever encountered a being comparable to Hesperus. Perhaps this was the first time it had sensed the presence of a being of similar complexity to itself, albeit of an entirely different embodiment and origin. The extremity probed nearer, and I made the error of believing that we were about to succeed, that our offering would be both accepted and understood for what it was. Perhaps there was a moment of contact between one of the machines and Hesperus's gold skin, but the arm retreated with dismaying swiftness, vanishing back into the core precisely as if it had touched fire, or electricity, or some agonizing toxin. The core pulsed with a deeper, more profound blackness, and the roar, which had already sounded impossibly loud, intensified. The rain that I had felt earlier returned in slashing sheets as moisture was precipitated out of the air by the furious motion of those flocking machines. The epicenter of the cloud, which had begun to drift over the plinth, shifted directly over us. The spirit appeared to have lost all interest in Hesperus. "This isn't going right." "There's nothing we can do now," Perslane answered, as if I had been looking for reassurance. A multitude of flapping things descended to inspect us. There was a scissoring clatter as their wings touched each other, but I never saw one of the machines drop out of the sky or come to any apparent harm. Now and then one of them would hover directly ahead of me, fixing me with the intense sparkle of its lights, which obviously served as both sensor and communicator. Occasionally I felt the brush of cold metal against my skin, and though I did my best to stand unperturbed, it was impossible not to flinch. After one icy contact, I lifted my hand to my cheek and came away with blood on my fingers, yet there was no pain from the wound, and it ceased bleeding shortly afterwards. Perslane had been grazed as well, sliced on the side of her neck and on the back of her hand, but she appeared oblivious. I do not think the spirit meant to hurt us, merely that the actions of its individual elements were not as well coordinated as the whole. Then something unexpected happened, something Mr. Jinks had not spoken of. I felt the machines swarm around me in greater numbers than ever, until their flapping density hid Perslane almost entirely from view. They closed around in a fluttering mass, and all of a sudden I was aloft, suspended in the air, with the machines supporting my limbs. I called out to Perslane, but she could not have heard me above the noise of the spirit. The swirling darkness gave me a sense of motion, but I could not tell whether it was illusory or real. I began to tip back, but no sooner had I started than I lost all notion of up and down. I flailed helplessly, but the machines hindered my movement so efficiently that I felt like a dreamer, caught in some slowly stiffening paralysis. Abruptly there was only silver sand beneath my feet. I had been carried off the platform beyond its edge. I had seldom experienced an acute fear of heights, for in most circumstances I had been protected by the devices that watched over me, whether they were part of the clothes I wore, the robot aids that accompanied me, or the environment in which I found myself. Now that fear arrived in full measure, as if to repay me for the times I had evaded it. Dalliance could not help me now, nor Silverwings assist Perslane. My clothes were garments of dumb fabric, lacking even the ability to secrete medicine should I fall injured. But a drop from this height would result in worse than injury. This is how attrition happens, I thought to myself. You take one chance too many, imagining that all the previous instances of good fortune have somehow immunized you against hazard, when in fact you have simply been extraordinarily fortunate until now. I was thinking that when the machines dropped me. I could only have fallen for a second, but it might as well have been a lifetime. I had time to reflect on many things, not the least of which was the unpleasant circumstances that would shortly attend my imminent demise. I had always taken it for granted that I would not leave behind a body, and most definitely not a body broken and bloodied after a fall. From this height, those dunes would smash me as if they were rock. I wondered if Perslane was also falling, and whether we would see each other before the two of us hit the ground. I wondered if the machines had spared her, and felt a momentary spasm of resentment at the thought that they might have chosen her over me. Then I was not falling. The machines had swooped under me and arrested my descent. The dark mass coagulated around me once more, and I had the giddy impression of gaining height with immense speed, until the machines released me once more and I was in clear space, hundreds of meters above the platform, toward which I was rushing. Once again the machines came to my rescue. I was being played with, I realized, tossed around the way a cat may torment a bird. The same thing must have been happening to Perslane, although I was never allowed even a glimpse of her. I could not say that I became resigned to my fate, but since my death had clearly been postponed, I did become fractionally calmer, and my thoughts slowed down to something like their normal rate. I could not say how long the machines toyed with me. It may only have been tens of seconds, or it may have occupied several minutes. In the black furnace of their swarming, time had become as difficult to gauge as motion and position. But eventually it did end, and I found myself dropped unceremoniously back onto the platform, the impact hard enough to knock the wind from me, yet not enough to break any bones. Spread-eagled on the white ground, I gasped for air like a stranded fish. It was at least a minute before I could give any thought to trying to stand up. When I did, my chest was heaving and my heart hammering. The air was still furious with machines, but they were no longer approaching any closer than within a few meters of me. "Perslane!" I called out feebly, before gathering my strength and bellowing her name a second time.
"Campion!" she called back. "I'm over here!"
She was only a dozen or so paces away, but I only glimpsed her in fitful instants, as the curtain of machines thinned out momentarily. I stumbled in her direction, my knee aching from where I had bruised it in falling, and she staggered toward me, holding her arms out at full length as if she had become a somnambulist. We embraced and examined each other for signs of injury. Other than the superficial cuts we had already sustained, and the bruises that were hidden by our clothes, neither of us appeared the worse for our ordeal. "The fucking thing," I started saying. Perslane touched a finger to her lips. "It's still around us, and it almost certainly understands trans. You might not want to offend it." I nodded meekly, but my anger was still barely contained. I did not feel myself to be in the presence of something evil, but I did sense a wicked intelligence at play, like the mind of a naughty or mischievous child writ malignantly large. "I thought I was going to die," I said.
"So did I, but I guess we shouldn't be too surprised. They warned us it can get playful. Now I know why Mr. Jinx was in such a hurry to leave."
"If that was playful, I'd hate to see aggressive."
"We'd be in pieces down on those dunes. But something's happening, Campion." She peered over my shoulder at whatever was going on behind me. I spun cautiously around and saw that the storm had pulled back far enough to afford us an obstructed view of the plinth.
"It's taking him," Perslane said, with awe in her voice.
Despite its earlier hesitancy, the spirit of the air was now in full contact with Hesperus. It was not just examining him, though the swarm covered almost the whole of his body, but was dismantling Hesperus, consuming him in a wave that began at the rear of the plinth, where he was a fused mass, and progressed forward to the humanoid part of him that had seemed aware of our presence before. Where the wave had passed, nothing of him remained. Flecks and chips of gold glinted out of the whirling black funnel that was drinking him into the sky.
"I hope we did the right thing," I said,
staring at the spectacle with a feeling somewhere between horror and exhilaration.
"Is it killing him, or taking him away to make him better?"
"It could be incorporating his material into itself, or digesting his memories and personality."
Her hand closed around mine. "There was nothing else we could do for him, Campion. He was already dead. This was his last, best chance." After that, there was nothing more to say. We watched until the swarm had stripped the plinth bare, until the last fleck of gold had tumbled up the sucking spout, and the spout itself had pulled back into the roaring black eye. The spirit hovered above us for several more minutes, more lights than ever flickering in its belly, as if it had much to think about now that it had taken Hesperus. Then, quite without warning, the noise in the wind and the lashing rain abated, and the spirit moved its elements further apart, so that the darkening indigo of the sky shone through the gaps. Then the spirit gathered itself, undulated and danced for a number of minutes, and then shot away towards the setting sun. Perslane and I watched it until it was only a billowing smudge in the distance. Then we went to the shelter and prepared to wait until morning, both of us wondering exactly what we had just experienced.
Chapter 18. Bettany poured himself a measure of impossibly black coffee, shaking his head with an air of patrician disappointment.
"I hear that your little gambit failed. I wish I could say that I was surprised."
"We don't know enough to jump to any sort of conclusion," I said. It was morning, and the sky was cloud-flecked and more wintry than it had been before. It was as if the arrival of the spirit had heralded a cold new season. The flags on the bridges and walkways seemed to have faded overnight, becoming drab and washed out.
"Was the robot healed?"
"No, not yet."
"But nothing of him remained on the observation platform. The spirit destroyed him, which was always one possible outcome. How can there be any question of him still being healed if he doesn't exist?"
"We don't know that he doesn't exist. There's documented evidence of the spirit destroying things, taking them, at least, and then putting them back later."
"Nothing you can count on, though."
"It still happens."
Campion spoke up. "As a rule, the only times the spirit has done this has been when the offering has been something complex. It's like a child, fascinated by bright, shiny toys. Much cleverer than a child, obviously. Probably cleverer than most entities we've ever encountered. But it still prizes novelty and complexity, and there's nothing more novel or complex than another machine intelligence."
Bettany looked at him with his chin resting on his hands.
"So when do you expect Hesperus to pop back into life?
with his faculties magically restored. "We don't expect anything," Campion said. "We just knew that what we were doing wasn't ridiculous, that there was a chance of success. Hesperus must have thought the same, or he wouldn't have sent that signal to us." "It may not happen for days or years," I said, "but I think he will return. His essence has been incorporated into the spirit now, but that doesn't mean he can't be reconstituted. It took him apart like a puzzle, piece by piece, but it will have remembered where everything goes. It knows what he is, and what he was meant to be before he was hurt, and it can make him new again." "Well, I suppose there's no harm in taking an optimistic view." "It's no more optimistic than thinking we actually have a future," I snapped back. "It may be stupid and naive, but at least I'm not living under the delusion that we still have a line, that it's all business as usual. Look at us, sitting around this table as if we're all one big happy family." "I see you haven't got over the ship business yet, Purslane. I was hoping you'd be able to look beyond your own concerns and think of our wider responsibilities."
"Don't lecture me on responsibility, Bettany."
Campion touched my hand and coughed. "Did anything happen while we were away? The last thing I remember was Mazerian killing one of our prisoners."
"The cabinet killed him, not me," Mazerian said from across the table. She had a piece of bread in her hand, and was tearing into it with such violence that I feared she was visualizing Campion's neck. He was squeezed dry anyway. He wasn't going to tell us anything else from inside the box.
"Another day or two of trying wouldn't have hurt."
"Or a week or two, or a year or two. Where would you have drawn the line, Campion? Sooner or later, we had to dial him down."
"There are still three more," Aconite said. "We're not finished just yet." Campion turned to Seyfel, who had said nothing until now. She had been watching the argument with a look of skeptical amusement, as if we were all players in some performance of which she was the only neutral observer.
"Campion," she said, acknowledging his stare, "something on your mind?"
"Just wondering if you've made any progress."
"It's coming along. I've read in nearly everyone. But even missing a few, I already think I have enough of a signal to reconstruct your strand." She brushed a jeweled finger through her hair, hooking a white lock behind an ear. "I'll wait until I have everyone read in, though, before I start analyzing. What's a day or two more, when the ambush already happened more than a century ago?"
"The sooner we have his strand, the better," Bettany said.
"I'm very close, Bettany, and I have the navigation logs, the flight plans everyone filed before departing the last reunion. I haven't run a correlation yet, but as soon as I've completed work on the strand, that'll be the first thing I do."
"No sense in rushing things," Gallingale said. "If Seyfel's going to all this trouble, it'd be silly not to do the job properly, right?"
"Right," Seyfel said. "At least someone understands."
"It is most unfortunate what has happened," said Cadence, when we met the two robots after breakfast.
"Most unfortunate," Cascade echoed, his hands clasped demurely. "But you should not blame yourselves for this failure. It was clear to us that you had Hesperus's best interests at heart. In all honesty, he would probably not have survived the journey back to machine space."
"You thought he might," Campion said.
"We were erring on the side of optimism, so as not to discourage you too greatly," Cadence answered.
"The spirit has taken him," I said. "That doesn't mean we failed."
"How can it be otherwise?" Cascade asked softly, the way one might address a child who was under some fundamental misapprehension about the state of reality.
"It's taken things before," I said. "Sometimes it's returned them the same day, but it's also happened weeks or months later. The fact that it didn't put Hesperus back together last night doesn't mean it won't reassemble him at some point in the future. We just have to be patient, to wait for that outcome."
"Patience is one of our virtues," Cadence said. "Nonetheless, we are still obliged to return to the Monoceros ring at the earliest opportunity. We owe it to the Gentian line and the commonality. The sooner the news of your misfortune reaches our fellow machines, the better they can organize their response. You may not think a year or two will make much difference, given the enormity of the journey ahead of us." It had occurred to me, I said. But a thorough analysis of galactic history reveals that many events would have gone differently if critical information had arrived a year earlier or a year later. We cannot count on being exceptions. In other words, you still need my ship.
Regrettably, yes, Cascade said.
I guess I'm resigned to it now. You can take her whenever you want, as far as I'm concerned. I saw her when the sun rose, lit up like a morning star. It tore my heart out to know she isn't mine anymore. The sooner she's out of my sight, the better.
The robots glanced at each other briefly.
We will not delay in that case. An early departure suits us very well, and will hopefully cause you the minimum of distress.
I'd still like to empty my hold first. It may not mean anything to you, but there are things in there to which I have a sentimental attachment. The line didn't say anything about taking them from me, just the ship they're in.
Is there something of particular value? Cadence asked.
Not really, but they're part of me, part of my past. I like to keep things. Campion doesn't feel the same way, but I can't help who I am.
You should let her clean out Silverwings, Campion said, addressing the robots. It won't take long, and the ship will be even faster without all that dead weight in her cargo hold.
I see no practical objections, Cascade said, but it would be desirable to assign formal ownership of your ship to us as soon as possible. That way we will be able to familiarize ourselves with her control systems. Might we do that imminently? You could begin unloading your possessions while we are adapting to the ship. Once you are done, we should be ready to leave orbit with the minimum of delay.
Don't expect me to jump for joy at the prospect, I said.
We appreciate how traumatic this must be, Cadence said. It may not be much consolation, but you will have earned the gratitude of the machine people.
Hasn't she already earned it? Campion asked.
Of course, Cascade replied, nodding slightly.
I'm drained now, I said. Drained. And I still need to speak to Mr. Jinx about what happened last night. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to that. If it's all right with you, we'll go up to the ship tomorrow.
That would be most satisfactory, the robot said together.
Chapter 19. Mazarian's interrogations continued for the rest of the day. Purslane left me to sit in on them alone while she debriefed the Emirian scientist about our experiences in the Eye of the Spirit. Although there had been no public censure, I had the impression that Mazarian had been chastised for what she had done to Thorn, the Shatterling from the House of Moths. She might not have intended to kill him, but she must have known that the likelihood of him surviving emergence was not great. And while Mazarian might have convinced herself that he had said all he was going to say, I suspected that Aconite and the others were a lot less certain. Their presence was much more conspicuous this time. Mazarian was still leading the proceedings, but Aconite, Lucerne, Melilot, and Valerian were sitting in a separate row of their own, between the audience and the plinth. They did not say much, but Mazarian was paying them nearly as much attention as she paid the prisoners. Her every move was under scrutiny, and she did nothing without glancing at her four fellow survivors, seeking tacit permission to proceed. At the same time, there was something defiant, almost cocksure, in the way she conducted herself. She might have been slapped on the wrist, told not to cross the line again, but she had not been dethroned. That would have been an admission that Bettany and the others had made a mistake in handing this assignment to Mazarian, and that would never do. Mazarian seemed emboldened, not cowed. The caskets, three occupied and one empty, had been arranged in an arc so that each was visible to the other. Mazarian had dialed all the prisoners down to 100, and we were all dosed on synchromesh to an equivalent factor. The 12-hour interrogation session would have lasted a subjective interval equivalent to 7.5 minutes, scarcely enough time for niceties in a normal conversation. But this was not a normal conversation. Mazarian was ablaze with righteous fury, hammering each question home almost before the prisoners had had a chance to answer the last one. When she reached an impasse, she dialed herself back down to normal time and consulted with the four. The day still slammed by. At the end of it, she had made remarkably little progress. Facial matching had established that the two unknown prisoners might be lost chatterlings of Ectobius and Jotina lines, a supposition which caused no little awkwardness, given that we were hosting guests from those two lines. But Miserion had not been able to persuade them to reveal their identities, nor had they shed any further light on the nature of the House of Suns, which remained as mysterious as when Hesperus had first mentioned it. Grilso was the only one who showed a flicker of recognition, but even that might have been my imagination.
"I think we know each other pretty well by now," Miserion said to Grilso.
I remembered Melilot's comment about Miserion being zealous in her pursuit of the truth when the survivors were still hiding in the ruins of the reunion system.
"Make your mind up," Grilso said. "Dial me down or dial me up."
He had a rough, leathery voice, as if his vocal cords had been left out to dry in the sun.
"There are three of you now. Thorn died."
"Who's Thorn?"
"The Melictan Shatterling, your accomplice. The other two are an Ectobius and a Jotina. You're all Shatterling supposedly lost to attrition."
"You sound as if you already know all the answers, Miserion."
"I'm getting there."
She leaned back on her heels, stretching her back like a yawning cat. "I asked Thorn about the House of Suns. Now I'm asking you."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"It's a line, obviously. Joining the dots, the House of Suns is made up of Shatterlings who used to belong to other lines. Perhaps they need to replenish their numbers now and then, I don't know. Perhaps it infiltrates known lines by replacing legitimate members with perfect copies. If that's the case, then the real Grilso might have died millions of years ago. If you took his place during a circuit, then showed up at the reunion with his body and face, his genes, a set of his memories, we probably wouldn't have known the difference. Why did you do this to us, Grilso? What did we do to deserve this?"
"You existed. That was enough."
"You mentioned Campion when we were still in the ambush system. You were taunting us, thinking we'd never get our hands on the man or his trove. That was your mistake, Grilso. Campion survived, you see. He made it. And that means we have an excellent chance of piecing together the reason for your crime."
"I'm not stopping you."
"Watch this, Grilso. I'm going to show you exactly how serious I am."
Miserion moved to the second cabinet and placed her hand on the stasis lever. The prisoner, the one we thought was an Ectobius, squirmed in his seat, frightened by what Miserion was going to do next. He started speaking, but Miserion must have disabled the microphone amplifying his words.
"It's too late now," she said.
"You had your chance. Now you can make yourself much more useful to me by showing Grilso that I mean business."
I felt a tightness in my throat, the need to say something. Miserion shot a look at Aconite and the others, but there was no audible exchange between them. Miserion stiffened her jaw, nodded once, then yanked the handle all the way to the left. When the cabinet stasis bubble collapsed, it gave off the same muffled cough that had signified Thorn's demise. But the failure mode here was not quite the same. When the impassors released their hold on the man-shaped husk, only dust rained down. It formed a neat grey pyramid at Miserion's feet. She crouched down, cupped some of it in her hands, and then let it drain in dark banners through her fingers. Then she stood and ground her heels into the dust.
"Did you get all that, Grilso?"
she asked, moving to the other cabinet, the one that held the suspected Jotina Shatterling. "The same thing could be happening to you in a few minutes. I'm willing to do it, more than willing. Eager."
"We made your ambush painless," Grilso said. "There was no malice in it, no intention to cause you distress. It was meant to be fast and surgical. We are not monsters."
"You call me a monster?"
"Take a look in a mirror."
"Tell me why you ambushed us."
"What makes you think we know?"
"You mentioned Campion when you didn't think it would cost you."
"I was told it had something to do with Campion's thread. That's all any of us were meant to know. It was already too much."
"Who told you?"
I saw the fear crawl under his skin. Was that the first time Grilso had hinted at being in the service of someone else, a higher agency? If so, the indiscretion could not have happened at a worse time for him. Miserion was not going to let it go.
"You know what, Miserion, all of you," He glared at us from inside the cabinet. I know there's an audience out there. I can feel them. I still think there's a way to win, a way to destroy the rest of you. Why don't I let you claw yourselves apart like rabid wolves, looking for a traitor amongst you? Or maybe more than one.
There's no traitor amongst us, Mazarian said, with automatic certainty.
You think you'd know if there was?
Grilsa's smile was either insane or that of a man who knew he had nothing to lose.
There is one, Mazarian. Trust me on that. He or she, I won't say which, could well be sitting in your audience right now. And he or she knows exactly what happened and why. I wouldn't mind betting they're already making plans to finish the rest of you off, irrespective of anything I say.
Give me a name, Mazarian said.
That's the last thing I'm going to do. Figure it out for yourself. Do some more interrogating.
She touched her hand to the stasis lever of the Jurtina's cabinet.
A name. What if I said you were the traitor? Would you allow yourself to be subjected to questioning?
Don't do this, said the Jurtina.
Mazarian looked at him with weary skepticism.
Because you're going to tell me everything.
I don't know anything, only that we had to kill you.
Where did the H-guns come from?
A secret cache known to the Marcellines. Most of the weapons were decommissioned after the Homunculus Wars, but a few were kept aside, in case they were needed again.
Her attention returned to Grilsa.
Is this true? There was a cache, but the rest of the line didn't know about it. They weren't culpable.
We'll let the commonality decide on that one.
Mazarian returned to the Jurtina.
You haven't told me anything I hadn't already worked out for myself. Unless you're withholding information, you are of no further use to this investigation, except as a means to demonstrate my determination.
No,
the Jurtina said. Mazarian began to pull the handle towards the left, slowly this time. The prisoner began to speed up from our perspective, twitching and fidgeting increasingly quickly. Something exploded inside me.
Wait!
I shouted, before she had tugged it all the way across. There's got to be a better way than this. Mazarian looked at me with icy disdain.
Something to contribute, Campion. You've been spectacularly silent until now.
Dialed down, I said, conscious of the whirling hand on my chronometer. We can discuss this in real time.
I'm happy discussing it now.
Aconite stood and turned towards me, hands raised placatingly.
Leave this to us, old man. We've got it under control.
No, you haven't. Mazarian's burning her way through prisoners like she's tossing coals on a fire. There are two left. We can't afford to lose another one.
I only need one to talk, Mazarian said, and began to tug the handle towards its limit.
I dialed myself down. I was alone in a room full of superhumanly accurate wax effigies. I dashed from the audience, through the electric tingle of the screen that had blocked the audience from view, onto Mazarian's plinth. She was still looking at where I had been seated, but her expression was beginning to shift. It was like watching the beginning of a very slow landslide. Her head started to track, following the blur of motion that I must have made from her perspective. I forced her stiff fingers from the Jurtina's handle and pushed it back up to a high stasis level. Behind me there was a sudden commotion as other shatterlings emerged from Synchromesh. Mazarian's right hand started to inch towards her own chronometer. Someone grabbed me. I was slammed around by Aconite, his face a mask of uncomprehending disappointment.
You shouldn't have done this, old man. We owe you everything, but there have to be limits.
He was holding me against the side of the Jatina's cabinet. I might have been able to break free of Aconite, but Valerian took my other arm gently but firmly.
She's out of control, I said.
Mazarian emerged into real time.
Get out of here, she told me.
You're letting hatred get the better of you.
They hate us. Why shouldn't we turn a little of that back on them? Because we're Gentian. Because 6 million years of good work says we're better than that. In your world, not in mine.
She nodded at Aconite and Valerian.
He means well, but he can't be allowed to disrupt the proceedings. Have him taken outside. Bettany can decide what to do with him later.
Bettany, who had said nothing until then, stood from the audience. "I'm sorry, Campion, but we simply can't tolerate this kind of disruption. See yourself out, or we'll have you removed. I wouldn't want to do that, but if you will insist on bringing this kind of attention upon yourself..." He waved his hand in a gesture of surrender, as if my actions were a bewildering puzzle. "Maybe there's something in what the Giottina said," I replied. "If there is a traitor here, he'd like nothing better than for the prisoners to die. Then there wouldn't be any danger of one of them revealing his identity." "Go," Bettany said. "Before you say anything else you may have cause to regret. I'm disappointed in you, Campion. I thought you'd have the common grace to rise above Purslane's censure, and not make it an issue between you and the rest of us. I was evidently mistaken." "We suffered an appalling attack," I said. "It was brutal and came without warning. We're right to seek justice, right to go after those who wronged us, but that doesn't mean we get to throw away every moral principle we've ever abided by." "Times are different now," Mazarian said. "They made it this way, not us." At that moment, the door to the interrogation chamber was flung open, revealing the pink sky of an Emirian sunset. Disconcerted, I realized that we had already been inside the whole day. A Shatterling, Burdock, one of those who had been on patrol duty until now, stood with one of the masked and winged locals. "We're in session here," Bettany said. "It'll have to wait," Burdock answered. "The Emirians phoned me as soon as I came down from my ship." He stepped into the room, accompanied by the Emirian, and closed the door behind him. "It's about Seyfel," he said.
"What about her?"
"She's dead." Burdock paused. He was having trouble getting the words out. "She must have fallen from one of the high balconies. They found her on the slope of the benevolent structure, under the lowest level of Ymir." The flyer was hovering at the nearest landing stage, its wings thumping the darkening air. Bettany was the first to step aboard, followed by Burdock, Aconite, and Melilot. Galingale and Charlock boarded next, then Lucerne and me. Almost as soon as my foot had left the deck, the flyer was moving. An appalling drop opened up under me as I eased into the plush cabin. I shuddered to think what it must have been like for Seyfel, to be falling and knowing that no force in the universe was going to stop her. I had stood on the edges of 10-kilometer-high cliffs, far from the assistance of any guardian machine, knowing that it would only take a twitch of my muscles to send me over the edge. But until my encounter with the spirit, I had never fallen. I had never been pushed. Even then, I had been quickly snatched from danger, unlike Seyfel. The fact of knowing that your own death was not only imminent, but mathematically certain, carried with it a special horror. I hoped and prayed that Seyfel had been dead or unconscious before she fell, but I had a feeling we might never know for sure. If she'd fallen from a different tower or one of the bridges, she might have dropped right through the fingers, Charlock said. She'd have stood a chance if she'd hit the sand, wouldn't she? Lymax, the Emirian, looked back.
I'm afraid not. If the impact didn't kill her instantly, she would probably have triggered an avalanche and suffocated under the sand. If she didn't bury herself in it immediately, her bones smashed, that would not have been a pleasant way to die, I assure you.
That doesn't mean she was lucky, I said. Lymax looked grave.
No, Shatterling, it doesn't. But I am saying it could have been worse.
I realized, with a lurch of comprehension, how bad this was going to be for the Emirians. We had lost another of our number to attrition, which would have been bad enough when there were 1,000 of us, but was immeasurably worse now that we were down to 1/20 of our former strength. But the process had begun with the ambush. Whatever the details of Seyfel's fall turned out to be, her death was simply part of the playing out of that long, murderous process. To the Emirians, on the other hand, we were guests, travellers who had surrendered ourselves to their care. They had allowed us to live in their city, to have complete freedom of movement between Ymir and the other settlements, and in return we had agreed to be bound by their policies. Purslane and I could have visited the spirit of the air without the magistrate's permission, or the grudging cooperation of Mr. Jinx, but we had shown the Emirians that we were willing to take no for an answer, that we would not bully our way into getting what we wanted. We had left our ships in space, along with our robot servants and weapons, and come to the surface with only the basic amenities. Had this been one of our reunion venues,
The entire structure, the entire city, would have been a machine for keeping us from harm. No one could have fallen to their death. It would have taken a special effort of will just to graze an elbow. The lowest inhabited level of the tower was 100 meters above us. The foundations by which it was anchored to the sloping finger of the high benevolent structure were windowless and weather-worn, like the ramparts of a castle. Seyfeld's body lay about 50 meters downslope from the foundations, caught in the shallow ledge formed by the markings engraved into the structure's ebony skin. She had either bounced after an initial impact, or had been pushed sideways during her fall. The Emirian flyer came to a halt another 10 meters downslope from where Seyfeld lay. We got out cautiously, stooping against the dust-laden wind and taking meticulous care with every footfall. We were a safe distance from the edge, but I did not think much of my chances of surviving a slide if I were to lose my footing on the sloping, marble-smooth ground. Like a team of ants ascending the angled trunk of a fallen tree, we crept up to the ruined body of our fellow shatterling. It was worse than I had been expecting, though Burdock had warned me that I would not find it pleasant. The fall had smashed her body and disarticulated her limbs. One leg was bent double, forced back under her spine. The other thrust out at an unnatural angle. Her arms were broken in several places. The skin where her clothes had been ripped was bloodied and gashed, and bone jutted from an elbow and thigh. She must have bounced, I realized, either against the side of the building or against the floor of the benevolent structure. Of her head, there was little left to recognize. Her face was a red pulp, almost too abstract to elicit revulsion, but her hair was still recognizable, where the wind had not pushed it into the bloodied mess of skin and bone. I could not help reaching out and stroking a lock of it, white and pure as moonlight against my skin. That it was Seyfeld and not someone else with similar hair was confirmed by the multitude of rings on her hand. The hand was still intact, the fingers open and inviting, as if all she needed was someone to comfort her. "Seyfeld," I said, as the full reality of what had happened to her began to hit home. I felt a terrible sadness open inside me, a void through which the winds from the end of the universe were blowing. Gallingale, who was stooping next to me, placed a hand on my shoulder. "Whoever did this," he said quietly enough that only I would have heard, "will find them. We won't let Seyfeld down. We'll avenge her loss." Charlock had squeezed aspic of machines onto his hand, forming a black tattoo. Grimacing with concentration and the effort of kneeling against the wind, he held his hand palm down and open above what remained of Seyfeld's head. "I'm not picking up anything," he said, after several moments. "I knew it would probably be futile. But if I hadn't looked..." "You were right to try," Lucerne said. Bettany said, "We'll have to examine her brain for coarse structure, memories she hasn't yet committed to trove, thoughts frozen at the moment of shutdown. We may get something." "I wouldn't count on it," I said. "Extracting patterns from a mind was difficult enough when the person had just died, let alone after they had suffered a violent, damaging death several hours ago. All of a sudden, it hit home to me how profoundly, pathetically ineffectual we really were. We could move worlds, wrap rings around stars, skip ourselves across time and space like pebbles on water. None of that would make any difference to Seyfeld, though. There had been a human soul in that skull only a few hours earlier, and now no authority in the universe could bring her back. We were like monkeys, sitting around a fire that had just extinguished, wondering why the warmth and light had gone away. "We mustn't jump to conclusions," Bettany said as I stood back, a few strands of Seyfeld's hair still between my fingers. "She could have fallen by accident without anyone pushing her." "Do you honestly believe that?" Aconite asked. "I find it now harder to believe than that one of us killed her." "Then start dealing with it," I said. "Gentian involvement was always suspected from the moment we were ambushed. This just confirms it." "She was one of us. Could you kill me, knowing what you do? About who I am, what I've seen and done, how long I've been alive?" Bettany was looking at me with an expression that forbade an affirmative answer. "We're people who've lived through almost everything that matters. The few thousand years of recorded history that came before us was just a prologue, nothing more. The real story started when Abigail took her first breath."
were bookworms who've tunneled through the pages of history, I said, recalling how the vigilance curator had described me. It's not quite the same thing. But we know what we are. We know how precious we are. I couldn't kill you, Campion. I may not approve of the things you've done, the way you've flaunted the traditions of the line, but I still couldn't touch a hair on your head. It would be like destroying a monument, poisoning a fragile ecology, an act of vandalism, not just murder. I can't help but think you feel the same way about me. Of course I do, I said angrily, but that's because I'm not the murderer, nor are you if you really feel like that. But someone obviously doesn't. Someone saw Cyphel as an obstacle they could remove as easily as you or I would toss something into a disposal slot. Then they're not one of us. No matter what they look like, they're not Gentian at heart. I wish I shared your conviction. Bettany looked over his shoulder. I followed his gaze and saw a Gentian flyer, the same open-topped kind that had taken Purslane and me to the spirit, lowering down to us. We'll move her, Bettany said. Take her back into orbit. I can scan her aboard Adonis Blue. She's gone, I said. We have to try, Campion! He said this so fiercely that I began to wonder if he was close to breaking down. I remembered how overjoyed he had been when I told him the news of the survivors Purslane and I had rescued. Cyphel's death was hitting me particularly hard, but it was going to be difficult for all of us, Bettany included. Gentian line was down to 51 living shatterlings, and at least one of those survivors might well be trying to kill the rest of us. The flyer touched down. Through narrowed eyes I studied Cyphel and remembered how she had looked at breakfast. Already it felt like a lifetime ago, when the universe had been a simpler place, full of bright, primary colors. The wind intensified, lashing dust against my cheeks.